Today's program was brought to you by 100 Bogart Street, the brand new co-working space in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Learn more at 100bogart.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Hoonie Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I'm your host, Andrew Friedman.
I'm here as a kind of like stand-in.
So that is clearly, for regular listeners, that is not my wife, Caitlin.
I'm not his wife, Caitlin.
Who are you?
I promise you.
Tell us who you are.
I'm Boaz. I'm Andrew's neighbor.
You're my neighbor. Boaz Paldi.
Boaz Paldi. I live about 500 yards away as the crow flies.
Yes.
I came over. It's pitch dark outside.
Yes.
I crossed a very dangerous street called Crossbar in Hastings upon Hudson.
Yes.
It took a bit of courage, but I did it. And here I am.
Now, can we just explain for people who listen to the show regularly? I have a hard time doing introductions by myself. I need a co-pilot. I had an exhausting day yesterday. I'm getting ready to go on book tour in less than 3 weeks. And it just got the best of me. I passed out at like 9 o'clock. Normally, I need to have the flu to pass out at 9 o'clock. But I passed out. And Caitlin, my usually very dependable co-host, well, she's still dependable. I was undependable. Got on a plane and flew to London today for business. So I had no co-pilot.
And by sheer luck, it's about 8:15 now.
It's 8:25 p.m.
Usually I'm asleep at this time.
Oh.
Andrew caught me just before putting on my pajamas.
Here
I am.
So we're in the suburbs. You were like the volunteer fire department of podcasting.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I was going to do it myself, and then I just freaked out. That's pathetic,
no,
but
it's
true.
Like, it's okay. I mean, I just like, you know, but it was like literally seconds away from pajama time.
Okay. So first of all, Boaz, I don't know how often you listen to the show, but we're trying to keep the introduction short this year, so you'll be able to go home and get your beauty sleep soon. But I have been trying earlier in the show to name our guest. And this week, my guest is Chef Hillary Sterling.
Wow.
And Hillary is the chef of Vic's Restaurant in New York City. It's in, I was going to say Soho. It's actually in NoHo. It is just north of Houston. It's one of the restaurants owned by old friends of mine, actually, Vicky Freeman and Mark Meyer. And it's a wonderful restaurant. It sort of leans Italian. Hillary's from Sheepshead Bay originally, New Yorker through and through, someone I had not spent a lot of time with before this interview, but is super smart, very dryly funny, someone I just really enjoyed talking to, and not just about food or being a chef.
I look forward to hearing that.
Do you?
I do.
But you're not going to sit here and listen to it now.
No, I won't.
I'm
going to
take it on faith at some point.
But at some point in the next, you know, week or so, I'll listen.
This would be a good way for me to increase listenership. I should have a different co-host
exactly
every week, and
that's
then people will
week.
Feel
that's
compelled. It's. I mean it'll take a long time.
Yeah.
I'd be betting on longevity.
Yes, but it's still one a week that you can count on.
Okay, so just quickly, Boaz, since you're here, because it is fascinating, tell my listeners what you do, because this is fascinating.
I work for the United Nations.
Yeah.
I run advocacy and communication campaigns there. We work a lot on the Sustainable Development Goals, which is the agenda for a better world until by 2030.
Yes.
It's a full-time job.
Yeah.
It's pretty hard.
Yes.
And it's basically all about kind of getting people to have a better life, to have better opportunities, to have better places to live, to sleep, to eat, to drink, and equality. So we're all kind of like, you know, in the Western world, the Northern Hemisphere is a little bit better off than the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to kind of fight that and get, you know, everyone to be on equal footing.
Great. Now, the other thing people need to know about you is you are, you and your wife, Ruth, who we just met up here, so we've known each other less than 2 years. Ruth was the opening, is it pizzaiola?
Pizzaiola.
Pizzaiola of Pulino's restaurant, which was a McNally restaurant, which is now where Church Medea is in New York City. Ruth had spent time, used to be a writer for the AP, was in Rome, got into cooking, started cooking professionally. Hillary was actually just featured in an article about how few women pizza makers there are in the world.
Nice.
Ruth was the exception.
She was.
And you grew up around restaurants, and the two of you, when you two throw a dinner party, it is restaurant caliber.
Thank you.
It is restaurant caliber. You two are two of the most intuitive, unfussy, but super talented cooks I've ever known.
That's very kind of you.
And
coming
I should
from
say,
you, that's big. Thank you.
Well, and last summer, you guys, at my request, this is when they say you'll know your friends very quickly, and you may, you know, barely get to know your acquaintances in life. But having not known you very long, I asked you guys to throw or co-host my 50th birthday party at your home last summer.
It was really that was
and boy,
one of
did you guys
best,
step up
best evenings. It really
but
was
you guys
so much
really
fun.
Stepped up. We collaborated on the menu, and then you and Ruth said, Kate and I were prepared to cook with you guys, and you said, don't worry about it, and you guys just went to town.
We had a great time.
Yeah,
we
that was a
it.
Memorable evening.
No, it was really great.
Yeah.
And we loved meeting your friends. It was so much fun meeting everyone.
Yeah, it was great.
It was
special.
Really, it was really, really special.
Okay.
Can I just do a quick plug for your book that's sitting right in front of me?
Oh,
I'm
wow.
So
this
excited
is not,
about?
This was not a request.
So this is not a request. And I'm looking at this
book. You got to do it quickly, though, because I do it every week.
But I'm going to do it this time. So I'm looking at this book that is just so exciting. I've been hearing about this book for such a long time.
Yeah.
Andrew keeps going on and on about it a little bit. But holding it in my hand in hardcover with this amazing photo of these chefs. It's called Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. And it's coming out when?
February 27th.
I really, honestly, run out and get it. It's going to be amazing.
Thank you. Thank you, Boaz. No one will believe that wasn't scripted, but it's
not. It wasn't scripted, I promise. I work for the United Nations. I don't lie.
I don't know if that was supposed to be a joke or not. You know, it's 2018. Who knows? Up is down. Down is up. Cats and dogs sleeping together.
But anyway, we're very proud of this book.
Okay,
it's like,
thank
it's
you
awesome.
Thank you very much. All right, Boaz, thank you for joining me. We're going to introduce Hillary now. Now, the interesting thing in this interview is I've been trying to be more open this year and not wrestle people into my biographical format that I had in mind when I started the show. And as you'll hear in the show, not long before this interview, realized that Hillary had done a biographical interview, and a very good one, with the show The Line, hosted by Eli here on the Heritage Radio Network. And I didn't want to just go over the same turf. I didn't see the point in that. We're all friends here at the network. So if you want to hear Hillary's story, you should go listen to the show The Line, and you can find her episode in the catalog there. Hillary and I just kind of shot the breeze. We talked about a lot of stuff and touched on a lot of points in her career, but it's much more free-flowing than a lot of our conversations are. And I think you'll see why that was easy the minute you start listening to her talking about some impending travel that she had coming up. And if you stay tuned to the end, we talk about a P.S. that we were going to do, and we actually did do that. So there's a little time travel involved at the very end of the episode. I'll leave that there to entice you guys. And with that, I'm going to introduce our interview. Boaz, thank you for running over, putting out the metaphorical fire.
My pleasure. Anytime. I hope Caitlin goes to London a lot because I like this.
Oh, you can come back anytime. And I love your voice. I'm wearing my headphones while we're doing. You're so comfortable behind the mic. All right. With that, Boaz is going to finish the scotch I poured to thank him for coming over, and I am going to introduce my interview with Chef Hillary Sterling, recorded at Vic's Restaurant in the NoHo neighborhood of New York City just a couple of weeks ago. I hope you enjoy it. So what were we talking about a minute ago? We were talking about Mexico.
We were talking about Mexico. I can't wait.
When are you going to? You'll probably have been there by the time this airs. But.
I'm going at the end of the month, and it's the last year I went and I didn't feel like I completed my adventure on this island.
Now, what's the island?
It's called Holbox. Uh-huh. It's in the north of the Yucatan.
Yeah.
And like I got our cab driver to stop for tacos along the side of the road where he gets them. And this woman was making tortillas over wood fire.
Yeah.
She had the, you know, squash roasting and it was really truly amazing. And then this whole island has no cars. Right. There's no nothing. It's really amazing. And at night, all the food trucks come out, their little stands.
Yeah.
And we ate sopes every night for dinner or grilled fish that was caught that morning.
Yeah.
And it's a really quiet, peaceful place. There's no cars. You walk everywhere.
You must. That's normal for a New Yorker, right?
In some respects. It's like a mile to town. I'm hungry. Okay, we got to go walk a mile to town.
I guess that's a little crazy. I remember I was a kid growing up in Coral Gables, Florida, and my grandmother used to come visit from Philadelphia, and she would, you know, like, kids, let's go walk to the supermarket. We thought she was crazy.
Totally.
Like a crazy person.
It was totally different now.
Half a mile away. But that was, it's like the scene in L.A. Story where Steve Martin has dinner plans at the house next door and he drives next door. That's what Miami was like. But you must love this town if you're going back. I mean, of all the places in the world, if you're going back in a year.
I wanted to go to Oaxaca, really. So during the Christmas season, we're just working. And I sit down on a Monday night off and I'm like, okay, I'm gonna figure this out today. And, you know, I just couldn't figure it out. I was like, this seems like so much an undertaking to do it right.
Yeah.
And I was like, I just want to relax and I know I'm going to eat great fish.
Yeah.
I know I'm going to have a great time.
Yes.
And there's nothing to do besides walk to town to get sopes or go kayaking looking for flamingos that I still don't think they're there, but I'm going to keep looking for them. And that's it.
This was sort of a theme a little bit that started to emerge in the sort of the back third of the first season of this show, which just ended at the end of 2017. Chefs and travel. Mm. You just kind of smiled, like, look at you, you just completely brightened. But can you speak to this a little bit? Because I made a comment originally to Michael White, and then Curtis Stone and I spoke about this because he was just getting ready to launch a Rioja, a couple of months of a Rioja-themed wine and food menu at Maud in Beverly Hills. And the comment I've made is just about every chef I know, and I would include even line cooks who have no money, right? Mm-hmm. They get like four days or more off. They are on a plane or they are on a road trip. They are gone.
Mm-hmm.
What are the various things that a chef finds so appealing about getting out on the road, getting to a new place? What is it? It's the unknown. Distinct to this profession to me.
We live such a regimented life, what appears to be a regimented life.
Yeah.
I mean, our goal every day is to do the exact same thing over and over and over again.
Right.
So getting on the road, wherever it may be, it doesn't matter if it's a plane or a bus or a train. I mean, and to travel to find something, even if you don't know what you're looking for, It's a discovery. It's adventure. It's something new on your palate. It's brightening. It's like an awakening.
Right.
You know, we do the same thing every day with variations.
Right.
So like any chance of like...
Repetitive tasks
over and over and over again.
That's the life.
Right. That's what people want. They want me to make sure those carrots taste the same every time.
Yeah.
You know, that's not an option.
Yeah.
So like this kind of travel and me going back a second time to a place I go to Italy every year too. So that doesn't, you know, essentially I've been to Rome numerous times. And I went back again this year for the first time in 10 years. But I think it's more about being familiar and finding the next thing that you missed the first time.
Uh-huh.
As I said earlier, I want to complete my task of really getting to know this island.
Right.
You know, it took me three days to get this woman named Irma to talk to me.
Yeah.
Every morning I asked her for something in my very poor Spanish, and she fed me every morning after we ran a mile to go get sopes and gorditas and whatever. Yeah. And finally, the third day, she brought me back to her little kitchen, and she was cooking in these really seasoned cast irons and, like, fat, like lard.
Yeah, yeah.
And then told me about her mom. Her mom has a fish shack on the other side of the island. This island's like a mile long. I don't know how I missed the fish shack. So I can't wait to find Irma's mom's fish shack in a week. Like that's what I'm looking forward to.
And this I bet like you, in your, like, this is like in your head. This is a very romantic notion in a way.
I just want to go back and I want to. I know Irma's going to be there. There's no doubt in my mind that she has not left that island.
Well, this is some of the same stuff people find so charming about a lot of places in Italy, right? Mm-hmm. This kind of dependable, monotony almost, but in the best possible way.
I mean, there's nothing better than going to Italy and having your cornetti and a cappuccino. I don't drink cappuccinos here ever, but like, I feel like I need to every morning. Yeah. I mean, maybe I'll limit the cornetti a little bit, but it's so it. That's an experience and it's a way of life. Like we're joining what they do every day.
Right.
I mean,
so when you go to Italy, obviously that has a very direct connection to what you personally do here at the restaurant, right?
Yeah.
When you go to Mexico and you eat in Mexico, is there anything that you take from that that can be applied here that wouldn't be obvious to anybody else?
Oh, I love chilies. I mean, I think if you eat here often enough, you would know that I do love chilies immensely. If you think about this, and I have a theory that's a little bit off the wall that people do kind of laugh at me slightly about, but Southern Italy and Mexico have similar climates, and they do grow similar products. So, like, if you're in the south of Italy, you'll see prickly pears and cactus, totally in the south of Italy, and chilies everywhere.
Yeah.
If you're in Mexico, same concept. Except corn is not used in Mexico, in Italy, but only in Mexico. But their flavor profiles, there's this restaurant on this island that only does like grilled fish.
Yeah.
And they just serve grilled fish with lemon and olive oil. You would eat that same grilled fish in a different variety. It'd be a branzino, but in this, it's about simplicity.
Yeah.
And we'll bring back those flavors. And honestly, it's about the love of those people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we went to the same restaurant 5 days in a row for lunch. I never ate the same thing twice.
Yeah.
And experienced what the restaurant was supposed to be for.
Yeah.
And then at dinner, like we went by to this place and by the fourth night, you know, the gentleman was so excited to see us, even though we were just eating fish and moving on. And he wanted to do a shot. And I was like, oh God. But I just wanted to like get like, not that chef anymore, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah. It's a slippery slope.
Yeah. But it's about their love and their passion, and that's what I would bring back from it.
Right.
And I do really, really, truly love Mexican food.
Uh-huh.
The day before Thanksgiving here, it's an annual tradition. I cook Mexican Thanksgiving for the entire restaurant.
Is that right?
Yeah, you should come. It's fun. It takes days.
Now, I'm going to say what I say to anybody when they offer me a sofa or something like that. I'm going to give you a chance right now to take it back.
By all means.
I actually will show up.
You should.
Yeah?
Yeah, we all sit down on it's the one day of year that like.
Do you do it on Thanksgiving?
No, we do the day before.
The day
we're closed
better.
Here on Thanksgiving. Yeah. So we do it Wednesday, depending on my travel schedule, Wednesday or Tuesday. But
yeah.
And over the years, we started this back at Avoce in 2009. And I've continued the tradition every year.
Uh-huh.
And it just gets better and more intricate. And
you cook?
Mm-hmm.
Just you?
Yep. The cooks get involved now because they get excited about it. Yeah. But I make the turkey mole. And every year I pick a different region of Mexico to really inspire me.
Yeah.
And I research the regions of Mexico. And then I write the menu just like I would for any menu we do here.
Yeah.
So it's kind of...
Now, where did you get... I know you spent, what, about 3 years earlier in your career working at Mesa Grill for Bobby.
I did, yeah.
I was going to say in my head, I was like, where did you... I mean, I assume there's probably people in the kitchen here who grew up, maybe not specifically Mexican, but eating food in that general realm. You're from Sheepshead Bay. I was going to say, where did you get your chops that you could cook for a bunch of cooks who probably grew up on these flavors?
Yeah, you know, it's...
And then it occurred to me maybe a little bit of that was Mesa.
There were these two chili posters on the way up to the office at Mesa Grill. This
were they the Mark Miller posters?
I don't know. Maybe. I have no idea. We should text Bobby and ask him.
I bet they were the Mark Miller posters.
There's like the dry chili and the fresh chili poster. Yeah. You walk up those stairs to the office and you walk past these chili posters.
Yeah.
That it still stayed with me to this day. You know, the flavors that I cook with now are about passion and love for them. And I think it also what keeps my staff and longevity with them and with us here
yeah.
is because I do spend this time and I do cook the way they want me to cook
mm-hmm.
and they want to eat this food and they want to really spend the time. I take so much passion in cooking Mexican food for them. It's so yeah. nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
Like, there's a mix of Ecuadorian guys and Mexican and Dominican,
yeah. Yeah.
but they all really, like, those flavors really resonate to them. And I think doing this for them as a whole
yeah.
Makes them feel a little bit more welcome, and this is their second home, regardless.
It's a great gesture. I mean, I can only think of two. I'm sure there's way more. Actually, three. I can think of three restaurants I know of over the years where chefs do something like this. You know, I know back in the day, the Waltucks at Chanterelle used to use their dining room for that for Thanksgiving. They weren't open. I mean, years ago, nobody was open for Thanksgiving. That started to happen, I guess, in the mid to late 90s. Hotel restaurants were open.
We were open at Mesa Grill. I still have, like, nightmares.
Were you really?
Like Chipotle mashed potatoes, and my
I'm
arm was
guess
so sore.
Cornbread stuffing?
Sure. Stuffing. I just remember this, like, I remember being so sore after,
yeah.
like, 400 Thanksgiving customers.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was so long ago.
Are you cool for associating like this?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll be totally honest. I heard your, when I was getting ready to talk to you, your interview. I'm going to plug a fellow show on Heritage. But I heard your interview with Eli Sussman.
Yeah, he was great.
On the line. And it's kind of the kind of biographical interview that I often do. And it's there. And it wasn't that long ago.
Mm-mm.
So people can listen to that interview if you want to get Hillary's entire story.
He was great. I had no idea what we were talking about until yeah. I sat down.
But we're going to, well, that's what we were going to talk about. But I just thought, you know, this is much, I mean, you and I don't even really know each other.
No.
I mean, we've talked a couple.
Yeah.
Hello, good to meet you. Good to see you again. That's literally our entire relationship.
Until now.
But I feel like this is fine. You seem fine talking like this. And I think it'll be something different for Heritage listeners.
Wonderful.
Well, since I brought it up, what was it like working at Mesa Grill back in the day?
It was amazing.
Yeah?
It was really amazing because we had the best of both worlds. Bobby's office was still upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
And this was back in the day where he was still in the kitchen. And, like, every day you saw him. And
that was his only restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for people to understand this. All these people who have empires now, there was a moment where they all had one place.
You know, and eventually I transitioned over to Bolo once they opened because I really wanted to learn Spanish food.
Mm-hmm.
I loved working there. It was such an energy. It was a camaraderie. It was when restaurants, we would go bowling the front and the back of the house every Monday night.
Yeah.
Our chef, Neil Manicle, who I actually was texting with yesterday, just totally unrelated.
Yeah.
We were, because Bar Americana closed yesterday. So.
Oh, I didn't know that.
They did.
Oh, that's a shame.
So we were texting about that because he left Mesa to go open Bar Americana and left us behind kind of thing with somebody else. And we were learning. And, you know, that was those moments where I sat there and, you know, the cooks in the kitchen, some helped and some didn't, is where I really saw, like, that true, you know, who was the team player and who wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember asking someone, I was putting a chili relleno up to the window, like, one of my first times, like, not doing this dish. And I looked at one of the guys, his name was Patricio. I said, is this correct? And he said, yes. And I put it in the window, and that it was not correct by any means whatsoever.
And he knew it, you think?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It was a good, great learning experience for me because then I figured out what made these guys tick.
And but why would a cook do that to someone else? Was it they didn't care? Was it they wanted to advance before you advanced? Do you have any insight into why that person would do that?
I have no idea why.
But
and years later, I mean, I spent almost 3 years there. You know, he still stayed in as I transitioned from a line cook to a sous chef there, he still stayed and he respected me. But it took a while. I had to earn my stripes. I had to show them I could cook to actually, like, understand.
Yeah.
Like, I had to literally throw down on the line with them.
Yes.
400 covers a night and be okay.
Right.
And then they were fine.
But that restaurant, you know, it's interesting to me. I'm always loath to go to the topic of gender, right? I always say this. I don't think it's like my standard disclaimer. You know, I don't think people get into the business because they want to be a woman chef or they want to be a minority chef or they want to be a gay chef. People just want to be a chef.
Right.
But it is conspicuous to me, especially for the time. Bobby had a lot of women fairly high up. Katie Sparks, I think, was a sous chef there.
Yeah.
Patricia Yeo
rose
up the ranks there. Mm-hmm. That was a really encouraging restaurant for women at a time when there were still these kind of vestiges of, well, there still is now, but, you know, this sort of kitchen chauvinism or worse. A lot of women were treated, as far, I've heard it from Katie and I talked at length about it once, with a lot of respect, and I've been told that people kind of threw attitude at them, that he would get their backs and kind of...
I never felt like I was any different than anybody else in that kitchen. It was, you know...
Did that seem remarkable for the time?
I guess I never even like, I mean, people have asked me now, you know, that, and I didn't, I'd worked for some Irish chefs before I got there when they tortured me, you know, in a fun like way, but they tortured me a little bit. And I never thought about the fact that I was the only woman in the kitchen at the time.
Yeah.
And I never thought, I mean, a woman hired me for, like, one of Bobby's assistants at the time, a sous chef.
Yeah.
She had hired me. Mm-hmm. And it never, I always assumed I was going to be a minority in the kitchen.
Yeah.
It's not why I chose this profession.
Sure.
I don't know, I always felt warm and welcomed in that group.
Yeah.
And I stayed with them a long time. And
it's always been interesting to me about that, Russ. It's something at a time, you know, that was an era, it's still an era, I think, where people, I just finished writing a book about the chefs of the 70s and 80s and the early 90s, which was the time Bobby came up. And I do, that restaurant comes up in a lot of interviews.
It was amazing. It was fun. It was like, I have not a bad word or an experience in that restaurant. I look back still fondly to this day.
Yeah.
People do, they're like, where did you start? And I'm like, well, I started an Irish pub in Montauk, but somehow I found my way to Mesa Grill. And, you know, and I proudly made all of that food, and I could still probably do it to this day.
Yeah.
And it's really, it's, I don't know, it was a really fond experience for my first New York City, like, real job.
Yeah. Now, Bobby, I think, is also somebody, if we could just take 2 seconds. I don't know him that well, but I think he is somebody who is kind of misunderstood in the business because he's become so well known because of all the television stuff. Bobby loves to cook.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. 100%.
Yeah.
He is a great chef.
Yeah.
A great man. Like, I have only fond words and fond experiences with him.
Yeah. What was he like back then? Did you have a sense he was headed for where he was headed? Was there any kind of...
I think I was just like just wide eyed. I'm like, I have no... Oh my God, I'm Brunoise poblano peppers. Right. I don't know.
Right.
My knife's not sharp enough. Right. I have these like scary memories in my head of my knife wasn't sharp enough to get through a pepper. They were beginning to do all this stuff.
Yeah.
Like Mesa Grill Vegas had opened at some point towards that, and Bolo and Bar Americana, all this stuff was opening. And I got to be a part of it, watching it and helping. And it was really, you know, he loves cooking. And I remember one time, this is one of those things, he came in and he goes, did you do a line check? I was running the pass.
Yeah.
And I said.
So you were at sous chef level at this point.
Yeah. And I said, no, that guy in the corner had been here for like 10 years or whatever, how long it had been. I didn't check his... shrimp tamale sauce, the cream, roasted garlic cream sauce.
Can you just quickly interject a definition of what is a line check for people who don't
know? So what we do every day before service is we go through the entire kitchen and we make sure everyone has their mise en place and their mise en place is correct.
Yeah.
So once service starts, it's kind of hard to fix something.
Yeah.
So I didn't check. I don't even think I understood what a line check really was back then.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's like 9 spreadsheets and,
and systems.
There's so many systems in place.
Right.
And he walked over and tasted it, and it was wrong. And I was like, oh, like crushed.
Yeah.
And, you know, he said to me, he looked at me, he goes, just because he's been here so many years, it doesn't mean he can't make a mistake.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I was like, you're right. Sorry, chef. And we fixed it, and I learned my lesson.
Yeah.
And I've never, like, I have so many moments in that kitchen like that.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many learning experiences in that kitchen, and that he allowed me to make mistakes and grow, and he was there to help us grow.
Yeah. The most amazing thing I ever saw in the realm of what you're saying, which to me was just incredible. I did a book several years ago, and I got to trail just as an observer, obviously, at the French Laundry kitchen.
Wow.
And Tim Hollingsworth, who now has OTM restaurant in Los Angeles, was... It had been announced he was going to replace Corey Lee, but he was still one of the sous chefs there. And I was just watching one night in the corner, and I believe the term they use there is out of place. where's your, you know, there's an out of place list. And what that is a list of alternates for dishes. So let's say it's a tasty menu only there. Somebody wants, there's a lamb dish on the menu. Somebody doesn't like lamb. What can we offer them? You know, what other meaty proteins, yeah. right? So in the middle of the service, Tim was getting a little, there was some, it just wasn't the most, I mean, things, compared to most kitchens, it was fine. It wasn't quite up to standards there. And Tim was getting a little annoyed. And then he said, he goes, and also there's no out of place list here. And he turned to the chef de partie on the meat station and said, somebody doesn't want lamb. What can we offer them? And the guy goes, you know, just complete deer in the headlights. And Tim goes, beef, what else? And the guy's like, Tim goes, duck, what else? Pork, what else?
Oh, God.
Timmy, before service, because he was expediting that night, had gone through everybody's station, had looked in everybody's, I don't know, the low boy box refrigerators. Mm-hmm. He knew what was in every square inch of that kitchen. Mm-hmm. And the person on the station didn't even know what they had under right below their knees.
Isn't that crazy?
And that was such a moment for me as somebody who studies what people like you do. And there's a line about writers, you know, that writers, I heard it once at a screenwriting seminar, writers should know their world the way God knows the universe, right? And I thought, that was the moment where I thought, same for chefs.
That's a great, yeah.
Chefs in their kitchen.
I walk through that kitchen all day long.
Do you?
I open the low boys, I check things, I tasting. Yeah. I mean, every time they're cooking a vegetable in this kitchen, it's very rare that I walk by. I mean, the kitchen's not big.
Yeah.
You know, there's not that much space to cover.
Right.
And you can see everything from the past.
Uh-huh.
And you can hear everything from the past. Like, I can hear what's cooking in the hood in the pasta tank right now. It's weird. It's crazy. Sometimes my senses, I'm like, it freaks me out a little bit when you hear the squid hit the fryer or like this noise. And but yeah, it's constant. I ask questions all the time that I already know the answers to.
Are there any things that come up a lot?
I mean, there's a lot of little things.
Yeah.
I mean, it's about details. Like we cook so simple that like a vegetable, if it's wrong, it's wrong. There's nowhere to hide. If that carrot or that Brussels sprout is not seared or cooked, you can see it and taste it.
Yeah.
So it stems a lot of it from the beginning.
Yeah.
And like it has to, all the details have to line up.
Yes.
Because otherwise, you know, that lemon's not going to be right or this is not going to be right. And people always ask the cooks, every cook walks in this kitchen in their first week after they're cutting lemons and wrapping them and ask me why I don't juice lemons to put in dishes and put it in a squeeze bottle. And I was like, well, how do you control that? How do you feel that? Like, how do you know when that lemon's enough? We talk in this kitchen in the half lemon, quarter lemon, whole lemon, two halves. Like, that's how much needs to go in a dish.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, they're going to squeeze. And then that lemon juice is never going to be fresh.
Yeah.
Never going to be bright. But every question, every cook without fail will come and ask me that question. Once they get comfortable enough after, you know, they're like, so can we juice this?
Right.
No one else in the kitchen has ever done that.
Do you like the question? Do you feel like that is a question that when it comes to you and you answer it, someone's going to instantly understand you exponentially more than that simple answer? Do you know what I'm saying?
I do. I don't know.
Does that give people insight? Does it give a?
I think it gets them ready to what they're just walked into.
Okay.
I think they...
Well, that's... Yeah.
Because we cook in this kitchen. We have recipes, but we cook by taste, and we cook by touch, and we cook by sight.
Yeah.
Pizza and pasta are their own animals, and there's no way to gauge.
Yeah.
You know, a pasta cooks differently in the front of the tank than the back, and if we don't actually show them and teach them what it looks like and what it tastes like, then that's not going to help them. Because I can say 9 minutes today, but every box of dried pasta or every fresh pasta is different.
Yeah.
So they have to use their senses all day long here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we focus on teaching them. Whether they accept it or not, you know, it's really hard. It comes from the heart. Like if you don't like cooking and you don't like eating, then like this kitchen 100% is not for you. Because we're constantly eating vegetables and constantly eating pizza. I mean, we eat pizza more than we should.
Uh-huh. You mean your own?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of, because pizza is one of those things, once you put it in,
right.
There's no going back. It's not
the train has left the station.
It's done.
Yeah.
Like, you can't fix it.
Right.
So there's a soggy part or a hole or there's no going back. You have to do it all over again. So we teach them about I'm working with one of my cooks right now on being flat-footed. He's flat-footed.
How would that affect someone in a kitchen?
He's waiting. He's waiting for something. Mm-hmm. You can't wait for anything here.
Yeah.
There's no waiting. You have to be proactive. You have to go for it.
There's a phrase in tennis. Excuse me. You need to play the ball. Don't let the ball play you.
Mm-hmm. I'll start using that one. I like that.
Awesome. It's one of my. It applies to everything.
It's at Avoce. We used to have a board like that of like quotes.
Uh-huh.
Most of the time, they were just random stuff I'd say in the middle of service. Yeah. In like the heat of it. Like,
yeah.
You know, there was one time the pasta was really soupy, and I was like, the pasta wants a sweater and not a swimsuit, is what I told the cook, and they just stopped in their tracks. And I was like, we'll just put that one on the wall, and we'll discuss that one later, but keep moving.
Right. You could have probably gotten a book out. You probably could have gotten a book of, like, you know, pictures and captions.
Oh, we just had this, like, white dry erase board right in the kitchen, so it was always a perfect time for, like, random quotes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's about teaching. It's about... feeling and acting.
Do you like that part of the job?
Yeah,
I mean,
I
love beyond
it.
The fact that it is essential to success, right? You like teaching people?
There's no other way anymore.
Right.
And yeah,
but I mean,
love
do
it.
You enjoy that?
Yeah, totally. Absolutely.
You do.
The moment when that pasta hits the pan and you can hear it and you know it's right, and that cook finally got it, it's amazing.
You just said something that has not come up in any interviews, but it's I've discussed this with other chefs. People talk about sight, smell, sound in a professional kitchen is useful.
Oh my God, it's like the backbone here.
But what kind of things do you learn? What kind of things are you listening for during a service or during the day? What are the tells of things going well, something going wrong?
Well, you can hear, like, it's rare we have we always have a couple of proteins on the menu here, so I'm always listening. And this week, because of the weather and all this stuff, we have Spanish mackerel, which I do love, but they have to sear it. And this is now we're throwing a wrench in there. There's not many burners back there. And I'm listening to make sure that noise of the fish hits the pan is correct.
Which is what?
You're hearing that, like, that sear, but not an explosion.
Not an explosion.
It's like a quiet sear, but you know that it's hitting it and it's not using too much oil to shallow fry.
Uh-huh.
If it's like a rapture, like rumble, then there's too much going on.
Like an electrical fire breaking out.
You're like, oh my God, just stop right now.
Right, 4th of July.
Yeah, that's something is wrong.
Yes.
You know, we're listening for pasta to emulsify and absorb, and we're listening for noises, because there's a certain noise, if anyone listens to this and has ever worked with me, they'll start laughing now, just because it's a little thing that once the cook finally learns, you'll whisper it in their ear and tell them what that noise is, and I can't say that right now because maybe one day you want to spend a night on pasta with me, and I'll tell you.
Okay.
But there's a certain noise that it makes, and I can hear it from the pass, and I know that pasta has absorbed enough of what it needs.
Wow.
And then it comes to the window, you get that shine. You know, we taste so much food in this kitchen because there's so much room for error.
Yeah.
We don't portion our pepper for our cacio e pepe. We crack a pepper mill every time.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of, like, and because of our use of chilies and acid, things can go awry really quickly.
Yeah.
So it's about trusting the cook and teaching them.
Yeah.
But it's also about using our senses to make sure that they're on the same page.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember as I say this, if I said this in another, because I'm going on book tour, I'm taping a lot of interviews.
I'm excited
in
to
advance.
Read it.
Thank you very much.
I'm super excited.
Thank you very much. So I can't remember if I said this to someone recently in an interview or not. So I may edit this out, or maybe I'll leave it in. People hear it twice. You know, years ago, I was at a restaurant. I was at the original John Dory Oyster Bar that was on 10th Avenue in New York City.
Oh, yeah.
And it was late on a Friday night, and I came in. I was actually with Gavin Kazin, who's in Minneapolis now, Chef Gavin Kazin. Hi, Gavin. Jonathan Waxman and some friends had just left the restaurant. And I was going on and on and on about how much I love Jonathan's food, which, as you know, and most people listening to this probably know, is super simple.
Oh, my God.
Very much in the vein of what you guys do.
Absolutely. That kale salad.
There was a couple next to us kind of eavesdropping, and I made this comment. I said, you know, I was talking to Gavin about Jonathan, and then it was a man and a woman, and the woman said to me, I'm sorry, I couldn't help interrupting and overhearing. What do you think is so wonderful about Jonathan Waxman? And I said, do you cook? She said, yeah. I said, okay. I said, well, why don't you go home he has a dish on his menu right now at Barbudo. It's, now I remember this 8 or 9 years later, this story. I said, it is shaved asparagus, walnuts, pecorino, olive oil, lemon juice. Why don't you go home and try to make that dish look and taste the way it tastes coming out of that kitchen? I guarantee you, yours is going to look like somebody just bust the table. And it's going to taste like nothing. That's the challenge of simplicity.
Yeah.
You know? And I've told Jonathan that story many times. I think he makes his, I think he loves hearing it. But that, to me, is the thing that it's really hard for people to grasp, unless you cook. Mm-hmm. And especially the volume, that's the other thing. I mean, it's one thing to be at home where you can fuss over something.
You're making, you know, one, you're order making or something. One,
you know, but the, you guys are cranking out, you know, dozens of some things in the course of a service.
Yeah.
Each one needs that, I mean, if you want to be slightly corny about it, that love and also that ability.
Yeah.
How do you hire for someone who's capable of doing that?
I mean, I do ask them where they like to eat or what they like to eat. I always ask that question. And it doesn't matter what they say. Yeah. But it's just kind of a gauge to see who they are.
Yeah.
Do they like cooking at home? Great. Yeah. That's awesome. Where do they like to eat? Maybe I didn't know something, and maybe I'm going to go find that place.
Right. What about from a technical standpoint, though? Is there an audition thing they do,
or
do you just have
the
them trail?
With us, yeah. You know, but honestly, it's if they can hold themselves in the kitchen, yeah, we can teach them the rest.
Will you take somebody pretty green and
and
like in the old days, and mm-hmm, just like teach them from scratch?
All the time.
You do.
Because we have a nice relationship with the culinary schools,
uh-huh,
and especially Natural Gourmet. The Natural Gourmet loves us.
Oh, my God. This is only the second interview of school. I have to be honest. I had never heard of until I interviewed Amanda Cohen.
Oh, well, that's... I mean, they love her more. I mean, 100%. Well. But we've had some success. One of our Natural Gourmet students was here for 2 years.
Uh-huh.
Did not eat meat.
Yeah.
We had this chicken fat poached squash on the menu for a while, and she tasted it. She dealt with it, but she worked the veg station, and I do mix sometimes meat in there.
Yeah.
I mean, and chicken fat.
Yeah.
But so we do take the green people. I think it's great. Someone did it for me, so why can't I do it for somebody else?
Right.
You know, my first job was frying black and white pudding at O'Murphy's Pub in Montauk, like making French fries and, you know, putting the shepherd's pie in the microwave. Like, that was what I did.
Yeah.
And someone gave me a job and showed me how to do it.
Yeah.
So why shouldn't we do it for somebody else?
That's great. I love it.
I mean, if they don't want to learn, I can't help them.
No, but to me, there is this very, it's the second time I've used it in this interview, but, you know, there are certain very romantic notions to me about this craft in this profession, mm-hmm, and one of them is the notion, not as much as it used to be, but, you know, the notion that a kid can go knocking on a kitchen door, and if it's the right day and they catch someone at the right time, they might be taken in, and they might, in the way that an apprentice or any kind of craftsperson might teach a kid any kind of tradition, something might be handed down. And that sounds very precious, but that is actually true.
Yeah.
I mean, that is how this business works.
It is. It's
even just in a city like New York, even in a harsh urban environment, and that used to be really like the norm. I mean, but now it still does happen. You don't have to have come through the placement office of a culinary school.
No, if you walk in, I've taken some cooks that have walked in the door.
Yeah.
And, you know, one just left after 2.5 years.
Amazing.
I took a risk. And he turned out great.
It was his first job?
He wasn't working in a restaurant like this. He was working in like small kind of, I don't even understand where he worked, to be honest.
Yeah.
And then when he decided it was time for him to go, he replaced himself with his cousin, who now is here and is great. And so there's this like family vibe that we like to maintain.
Yeah.
And I think it starts with me being in the kitchen with these guys every day. Like today I worked the pizza station at lunch.
Uh-huh.
And they love it.
Yeah.
We get to cook together.
Yeah.
I become a different person on those days.
Yeah.
To them. I still am the chef, but I'm cooking with them and we're cooking together and the food's going together. And there's this like, I'll help them, they help me.
Yeah.
It shows vulnerability for me. It shows all these things that to them, I think it makes me stronger.
Yeah.
Because that I'm with them and it doesn't matter. There's no hierarchy at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
We're together.
Yeah, and you still like copping on a station? And
I love it.
You still love it?
I mean, I prefer certain stations over the other ones
right
now,
but you
yeah, I have no
you
problem.
You still love it? You don't? You're not like, oh, I get to...
I worked Garmager on Saturday brunch.
Did you really?
I did.
Great.
So, no, I don't... I mean, I got nothing else done that day.
Right.
And all of a sudden, it's like 4 o'clock, and I was like, I still have to expedite dinner service. I'm exhausted. But, yeah, right. I loved it. It was
great. That's
great. Yeah.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick break. We are talking with Chef Hillary Sterling at Vic's Restaurant in New York City. And before we go to break, just a reminder, if you'd like to subscribe to the show, you can do that on Stitcher or iTunes. And if you would leave us a rating or even better, a review, we would really love you. And it really does help people find the show. You can also follow the show. The handle is at Chef Podcast. And that is good on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And we'll be right back. Like a four-leaf clover, shining like a penny bright, landing on all four feet like a cat who's ready for a wild night. My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
100 Bogart Street is finally open and ready for Bushwick. 100 Bogart is a brand new, state-of-the-art co-working space that provides turnkey workspaces, including open layout desks, meeting spaces, and furnished private offices. Members have access to top-notch amenities such as custom furniture, high-speed internet, spacious kitchenettes with coffee and tea, printers, scanners, and much more. Alongside their professional work environment, 100 Bogart also provides exclusive educational programming for any curious entrepreneur. Heritage Radio Network has made their new office home at 100 Bogart and will host many events there in the future. For more information about their co-working space, visit 100bogart.com and become a member to network, create, and educate.
And we are back talking with Chef Hillary Sterling at Vic's Restaurant in New York City. So I was going to ask you this before, as someone who doesn't know you that well. You seem, there is, not to overgeneralize, but there is to me, with a lot of chefs, almost sort of an inherent restlessness, sort of a nervous energy, you seem not to have it at all. You seem...
Well, I'm hiding it very well today.
You seem remarkably tranquil, is the word I would use. And it's striking me talking to you that there is a different energy about you than almost any chef I've ever interviewed. Does that seem like an odd comment?
No, I mean, I think we're all nervous at all times and we're all restless at all times.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're talking about
something.
You mean
people in general or you mean people in your line of work?
Oh, and I'm nervous all the time. There's like, I'm waiting for, oh my God, something, whatever. The pizza oven's going to blow up today or the, you know, we're going to lose something or... But we're talking about something I love to do.
Right.
We're talking about the fun parts about this job.
Yeah.
We're talking about the exciting, the romantic, the food. So that keeps me calm.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, having an open kitchen has definitely calmed me down over the years because you can hear everything I say and see everything I do at all times. And you're never alone anymore.
Right.
I'm never alone. Food is about passion and love. We should embrace that part of it. The customer can wait 2 more minutes. I would hope, I can get it right.
Right.
I would hope that's okay, but you never know. We can't control everything.
Right.
Food is about passion. And I really think that people need to remember that
when
they're eating out and stop sitting there and focusing on every little nuance and detail.
Right.
Enjoy it.
Okay, so it's the subject matter that is...
I think it's a subject matter. Okay. We talked about travel and food
it's funny when you say, you know, you're waiting for the pizza oven. I guess that is maybe... Distracted is maybe another word I would use that I would apply to most... I've always say my least favorite... It's funny because it's my favorite place to do these interviews. My least favorite place to have a meal with a chef is in their own restaurant.
Oh, no way. I couldn't do it. I can't. It's terrifying.
And if we do, they will not face the wall. They know every water glass that's not being filled. They know every... customer who's trying to, they're like, I always say it's like in the Terminator, you know, where the Terminator looks around and gets that readout. Like that's a chef's point of view.
Oh my God. You can see
they have like the total vision. They spot everything that's wrong.
People ask me all the time.
Nothing that's
forks.
Right. It's all,
oh God. You're like, you're sitting in the dining room. So they're like, excuse me, can I have a fork? Sure. And they go get my mise tray, put my fork on it,
right.
Walk over.
Right.
I'll take drink orders all the time.
Like, you mean someone will catch you as you're going through the dining room?
Yeah, I mean, because, I mean, there's four tables that are in the back kitchen area. So a lot of times, if someone's looking around, I'm the first person to catch their eye.
Yeah.
And then I get really lost because I don't know how to put it in the computer. So then I have to go find a server and tell them what the person wants. And
yeah.
I think...
But this is great that you actually will do that instead of let me get someone over here to do that for you. I think most chefs I know would be like, let me get someone over here to do that for you.
Why? I mean, it's we all know how to do it. We've all been working in restaurants long enough.
Of course.
I mean, I started in the front of the house, so that's kind of like my little bones of like, you know, I enjoy service.
Yeah.
And I, you know, yeah, can I see those water glasses? It drives me nuts. And I'm a person that drinks a lot of water. If anybody... That's one of my facts that I do drink an excessive amount of water. Yeah. So if I have an empty water glass or I see one, I make the runners go get water.
Uh-huh.
It's a constant cycle of service here.
What are the benefits to having worked in the front of the house?
There's pros and cons. Maybe I know too much. You know, I think you understand what it needs to get done.
Yeah.
There's a layer that sometimes chefs, as we miss.
Yeah.
I loved working in the front of the house. I've worked in some random places. I worked at a bar across from Wrigley Field after college. The beer tubs. I worked this restaurant in Montauk called the Blue Marlin. I would have to vacuum the carpeting every day. And I think it turned
this back when there were still smoking sections?
Mm-hmm, okay. 100%.
Yeah.
It was smoking sections in the front.
Yeah.
And and we had karaoke on Sunday nights.
Oh, my gosh.
And the guy started with Summer Winds every Sunday night. I can't not hear
that
song.
The summer wind came blowing in. I'm like, look at you. Like, you're in pain when I do
every
it.
Every time. Every Sunday night.
Like you're going to have a flashback.
Yeah. But I think that is what made this all possible. Those restaurants, those little details, these people put so much, these seasonal restaurants.
Yeah.
They put everything they had into these couple of months.
Yes.
And their passion for it kind of stayed with me.
Mm.
Or their survival mode stayed with me.
But there's also those kind of restaurants. So we were talking during the break about our mutual friend Jimmy Bradley, my old co-host. Last two summers, I borrowed Jimmy's place out in Rhode Island, not that far from Narragansett. And there's a couple of really amazing waterside restaurants there, right?
Okay.
And I had this revelation one day that, you know, there's places there with almost the same menu that are great, and places that are and places that are horrible, like really grungy and bad. And I realized how you really brings home to you a restaurants like those, that when the fundamentals are well handled, you don't have to be overwrought. You don't have to be reinventing the wheel. Great hospitality, great drinks. Every restaurant, the great ones all have amazing fries, right? That seems like such a throwaway.
Yeah.
Amazing fries.
What else do you want to eat at the beach?
Yeah, and just competent service. Mm-hmm. You know, people who seem to really care, who really want you to enjoy your meal. And nothing fancy about any of it, but there's some restaurants there that, you know, I saw on Twitter, Coleman Andrews said something like, forgive the carbon footprint, but I drove 180 miles today to go to the Matunic Oyster Bar. And that's one of the places we go like three times in the week that we're there. It's heaven on earth.
Yeah.
And I think Kate and I are going to, I think we're going to go before the winter's out, just go up there for lunch like some Sunday.
That's what you want. You want to walk into a restaurant and feel warm and fuzzy.
Yeah.
And that will make the food four times better half the time.
Yeah.
And I mean, you want to, the more you know about your guests.
Yeah.
The more you'll keep your guests.
Uh-huh.
And I know what half the people eat here at lunch. I know their names.
Yeah.
And when they want to talk, they talk. When they don't, they don't. But you want to make sure that, you know, I watched these people back in the Blue Marlin, Sue and Frank, know every single person that walked in that door.
Yeah. What was that restaurant like? I mean, that name conjures. I'm sure everyone who hears the name has their own instant picture of what it probably was. How big was it?
Oh, it was like, it was probably the size of this restaurant. It was probably 90 seats.
Uh-huh. And one room, two rooms?
It was one room. There was like a outside area, but it wasn't used. And it was almost like fine dining. Frank wore a toque and a neckerchief in the kitchen. No joke.
Yeah.
And Sue wore this like nurse's like shoes with black skirt and like white button down and ran that door like nobody else.
Meaning what?
Meaning she was like ran it with an iron fist but also with a soft hand.
Uh-huh.
So like she was like super passionate with the guests, but made sure that that table got turned. And there was
Was she artful about it?
I mean, I was like 14.
Did people know they were getting like the bums rush or?
No. Yeah. It was like they had that restaurant for 10 years.
So they had the timing down to a science.
They knew what they did until, the problem is they never evolved. Their food never evolved. Mm. It was always the same.
What kind of food?
It was like French food. There was like Wednesdays was like duck l'orange day and Fridays was like prime rib day. And there was like, I mean, we had to make these like peach Melba sundaes. That was my first introduction to real restaurant world.
Yeah.
And the details and the vacuuming and the curtains. There was curtains. Mm-hmm. It was dark and wood tables and yellow water glasses, that kind of stuff. Yeah. And making sure everyone had what they needed.
Yeah.
And I remember coming home with like $80 in cash and tips one night at 14 years old.
Yeah.
And then my parents took it. And it's fine. But because I hustled and I did whatever the server asked me to do. I bussed tables and I made sure those things were done. And it was about details. And I held my tray with my plates on it. I thought I was going to drop them.
Did you come to all of this naturally? Like when you got thrown into that environment, did it feel like a natural place for you to be? Did you find yourself able to take on even front of the house tasks? Like, did you just get it, as they say, right away?
I knew it was right. And I loved working in restaurants so much. I loved taking care of the guests.
Yeah.
And now we just do it in a little different way. But like, I loved being there for the guests and anticipating what they needed next.
Yeah.
And then after college, I was working in a company called C.H. Robinson. I was a logistics broker. I moved freight. And I was so bored. And I was like, what am I doing? I was like, I miss the restaurant atmosphere, the scene, the service, the passion, the hospitality. So I lasted like 2 years and then I was like, well, okay, time to go.
You're a native New Yorker. Mm-hmm. You were away for school.
Yeah.
You've been here most of your life.
Yeah.
Did you ever think about living anywhere else? And how has been being a native of the city, do you think, affected your understanding of the New York dining experience?
Oh, I have no idea what New York dining experience is, really. No
because
idea.
Why? Because it's so varied?
It's so it changes.
So personal?
I mean, my New York is like Sheepshead Bay, Coney Island.
Still?
I mean, no, not New York. That's too far.
What borough do you live in?
I live in Brooklyn.
You do? Okay.
Yeah, but I live right over the bridge in Williamsburg.
Got it.
I mean, okay. I can't move back there.
Hey, Sterling, don't get too big for your old neighborhood.
It's too far. It's like an hour away. I grew up, my Brooklyn and my New York is hot dogs and sauerkraut and pizza and
those are your
sandwiches.
Touchstones.
Yeah, so like, this New York we live in now on Great Jones Street is very different than those
times. It's almost like another city.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't understand. I mean, down here is so different, but in my entire career, I've never worked above 26th Street.
That's so interesting.
That's amazing. I mean, but it's so different. Each neighborhood is really different.
Yeah.
From those years at Lupa, that just south of Houston or north of Houston, that's a different neighborhood than this.
Totally.
And you know, up on, 26th Street is a totally different clientele and a totally different neighborhood. And
right.
I mean, we appeal to people here every day. That's what our goal is.
Yeah.
You should eat here every day. It'd be great if you did. But, I mean, that's what you should. We want to make sure that you're comfortable. We know your name. We know what you like to eat. We know what you don't like to eat. Mm-hmm. We have toys for the kids.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Toys?
I have dinosaurs over there. Yeah,
do
lots
you?
Of them.
Mm-hmm. Wow, not just like the standard like little 3-pack of crayons and.
We do have those too. Don't
you
worry.
Do?
And the wiki sticks.
Okay.
But we want to make sure that
it's like a good dish, right? You have the it has a certain familiarity, but there's also a little surprise.
Yeah. We like hide the dinosaurs a little bit, and we also hide the afikoman on Passover too. So
do you actually do that here?
Mm-hmm.
That's funny.
We do a fifth night of Passover dinner here.
Uh-huh.
So we do hide the afikoman. There's not many places to hide.
Yeah.
But we make it interactive and fun. Yeah. I mean, that's my New York dining. And I like my favorite places.
Yeah. What are some, can you name or do you not?
Yeah,
like
of course. I mean, I love going to East Sodi. It is like my, it's just sitting at the bar.
Uh-huh.
Sitting at the table is totally different.
Yeah.
But they're the place that like I'll walk in and they're like, would you like a Negroni this evening?
Yeah.
Sure. Even if I don't, but
right.
They already asked me,
yeah.
And I'm going to say yes.
Yeah.
Then I'm going to eat cacio e pepe.
Mm-hmm.
I love going to Uncle Boone's.
Mm-hmm.
You know, deep down, I do love red sauce,
uh-huh.
too. So yeah. you might find me at Emilio Bellotto's every yeah, once in a while,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Caesar salad and yeah. Chicken parm can yeah. really, you know, take you home. I love simple food, too.
Yeah.
And, like, Cafe Mogador for lunch is a really happy place, too.
Yeah. Don't you think most chefs like simple food? Mm-hmm. I think people would be shocked to know, even people who cook sort of whatever you want to call it, avant-garde, molecular, like, that's not yeah. what these people are eating in their off time.
No.
No, they're going eating tapas and eating the kind of food you make.
Yeah, I want to go eat tacos, too, and I want to eat, like, I just want to eat something that, A, sometimes doesn't taste like my own food.
Yes.
And B, like, something that will be just take my palate for a ride for that day. Yeah. I don't care how spicy it is or... You know, dim sum and dumplings.
Yeah.
I can't cook that food well. No way.
Right.
So it's great.
What, you know, we're sitting here in January. This probably won't air till early February. But looking ahead to 2018, as somebody who does what you do and have been in this restaurant for several years, what do you come to a new year looking to do? What are sort of the things that are on your mind? Or is it sort of just... You guys are in a good rhythm and you just want to keep it going.
I'm not a survivalist. I mean, I like to grow. I think, you know, I have these turnips downstairs. We don't repeat dishes here.
Mm-hmm.
Even people, if they ask, I'll do it for them. It's one of our little touches. There's a couple people that mm-hmm. ask once a year for me to make something that's been on a past menu.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll do it for them. But we don't repeat dishes. So every year we have to keep growing and we have to keep fighting. And I can't make a turnip dish that... I'm having a really hard time beating last year's turnip dish. And I know this is my life. This is crazy.
Yeah.
My turnips and rutabagas are like, we just want to keep pushing and growing and getting better every year.
Mm-hmm.
Finding new farmers to support, finding new people out there going to see them
mm-hmm.
and really, I mean, educating ourselves on how to make this restaurant. We're like 90% local.
Mm-hmm. Local meaning what to you? Like people who are either live or work within like a 10 block radius?
No. Or
you mean
products.
New Yorkers? Oh, your products. I'm sorry.
Well, we would be loved to. It'd be great. 10 block radius? No problem. I'll bring it to your house.
Your product's local.
Yeah.
Okay.
Our product's local and finding new people to work with. And we have a farmer that we meet with every year and we talk about what we want to grow.
Yeah.
And she'll grow stuff for us.
Yeah. What kind of stuff?
She grows a lot of peppers and stuff, and she knows about my love of chilies. So one of our imported ingredients in the kitchen is Calabrian chilies.
Mm-hmm.
We can't even, Campo Rosso grows Calabrian chilies, and Invincible Farms grows Calabrian chilies, but mm-hmm. even me drying them and soaking them and rehydrating them, it still doesn't taste like Calabrian chilies that you can get from Italy.
Do you tell them what you're going to be doing with it? Do you find that that is a useful thing for a farmer to know?
I think through social media, they can see it too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of it. It's kind of full circle.
Yeah.
Last year, Campo Rosso had a lot of Tardivo. And I cooked the Tardivo, we roast it. And Chris texts me, and I posted on Instagram, and I tagged him in it. And
uh-huh.
he's like, "You're the only person that cooks Tardivo. Thank you." And that was the end of the conversation.
Right.
And I was like, "Come by." And they're too busy this time of year. But, yeah, we like to we have a personal relationship with our farmers.
Yeah.
It makes it more fun. It makes it better. You treat their products better.
Yeah.
You know how much work they put into it.
Yeah.
And they know how much work we put into it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's kind of the vision of 2018.
Yeah.
Is to keep getting better and growing.
Great.
There's no need to just survive.
Great. Well, I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Me too. Thank you.
Thanks for making the time.
Of course.
I have to tell you, you know, I've said this recently. I consider it a sign of maturity in a food writer to not announce themselves in restaurants. But I don't think you know this. My wife's office is around the corner from here.
I do not know
and
this.
And she works at Scholastic.
Okay, yeah.
And we often find ourselves at your bars. Like, we went through a little Vicks phase in the fall where we were here several times
wonderful.
On Friday evenings. I once left my computer bag on a hook at the bar, and your wonderful staff had found it and had it safe and sound for me.
Wonderful. Look at that. That's
there's
amazing.
There's nothing like a writer losing a computer bag in New York City. You assume it's gone within about a minute. So I really do love it here more than you probably know.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. And that's it. So thank you for joining us, and We'll see you next time we come in.
Wonderful. Please announce yourself.
Sorry, one last thing. I want to hear, because this won't air for a few weeks, how the Mexico trip winds up. So I'm going to invite myself to either email you or maybe, I don't really do phoners, but maybe call you for a quick 60-second update.
Absolutely.
On whether you've attained your goals
trip. I'll show you a picture of Irma.
That'll be great. I'll put the picture up. We'll put it on Instagram. That would be awesome. Okay, thank you.
Amazing.
Okay, so fast forward.
Fast forward.
We are now in February. We are at Fairfax. Is this Fairfax Restaurant? Whatever it is. Cafe, restaurant.
I think it's
all day coffee and dining.
We're sitting on a couch.
It's one of my favorite hangs. Tell me, you reconnected with...
So this woman named Irma, who is basically La Reina of the Mercadito.
Yeah.
I got really disappointed. We turned the corner. The market had moved from a dirty parking lot to this, like, spot. And we stopped and asked somebody, and they, like, sent us to find the beautiful palapas, he said. He said, muy bonita palapas. I was like, okay.
Right.
So we start this voyage to, like, the other side of the town.
And you had no idea that this had happened in the intervening year.
The Google Maps still said the Mercadito was in the same, like, dirty parking lot.
Right.
And when I'm in a dirty parking lot, Fairfax is bigger than the market. And we turn the corner, and this, like, beautiful, beautiful stands with the exact same signs, dirty equipment. I mean, besides the exterior, the interior of the soulful real stayed the same. So it was really amazing. And I was so disappointed. And then I turned the corner and Irma was still there, present.
Okay, and, so that was reassuring.
Except she had more makeup on. She was like, literally looked like she like dolled herself up to get to work. Totally. I mean, wearing one of those Hugo Boss hats that just said Boss across it. Like,
now, this was, you returned to the same, we talked about this.
Returned
you went
to back the same
after
island.
One. Are you going to go back again?
I mean, I might. I mean, but I think it's getting a little built. There was a lot of construction going on, I won't lie. I mean, this was kind of a sign.
Losing its charm.
Yeah, I mean, it still had that soul that I needed, that I wanted.
Yeah.
But we ate at the same three places the whole time.
Yeah.
There was no...
You've done it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was like, I need to... But every morning, you went up to the Irma and asked her what she had. And every morning, you'd ask for sopes, and she'd say, tomorrow, tomorrow, tomorrow. And finally, we walked up the last day, and I said to her, you have sopes? And she's like, yes. I was like, no way. And she's like, yes. But she kind of like lured us back
day. So that was your perfect ending.
And every day there was a different meat, a different name that I was unaware of. So like the pork changed name four times.
Right.
And one day we got like ham. But the food was just, it was delicious.
Got it.
And it was simple, soulful, perfect,
something great
layers.
About that. I have one last question.
Yeah.
I thought when I met you today, you were going to be like, really super bizarre, you know, like over the top tan.
I mean, I'm a little tan.
You're a little tan.
The weather was a little windy.
Okay.
I mean, out of the 5 days,
yes,
I think,
for February in New York, you're tan.
Totally. I think
for a week in Mexico, though, you're not.
No, the weather was beautiful. It went from like 25 mile an hour winds to zero.
Okay.
To the point where there were waves one day and we were paddleboarding on the ocean the next day.
Yeah,
that's how
I
flat
it
was.
All right.
So, but.
Well, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
And all the best for the rest
of
the year.
I appreciate it.
Thank you. And that's our show. A huge thank you to Chef Hillary Sterling. A huge thank you to you, Boaz. You're still sitting here. This is only about a minute after we did the intro. Yeah, the miracle.
I'm going to be in my pajamas soon, though.
And as always, a thank you to Caitlin, who, had she been here, would have done the introduction. A huge thank you to David Tatasciore, our engineer, for splicing this thing together every week. David, thanks for the extra work. And if you'd like to follow the show, please do so. At Chef Podcast is the handle on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And if you would like to order my book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, How Food Lovers, Free Spirits, Misfits, and Wanderers Created a New American Profession, it is the story of the American chef movement of the 1970s and 1980s. I believe you'll enjoy it. I spent 5 years writing it. So I will be plugging it once a week, even when my guest co-host did it at the top of the show. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you back here next week on Andrew Talks to Chefs.